You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP, and welcome to Radio Free Book Club for March 2024. I'm Ken Honeywell. I'm a writer and reader from Indianapolis, and this month we're talking about wellness. It's the second novel by Nathan Hill, whose first novel, The Nix, was one of the best-reviewed books of 2016, landing on the best of the year lists at the New York Times, the Washington Post, Slate, National Public Radio, among others. Also won the Art Seidenbaum Award for First Fiction from the Los Angeles Times. It's a lot of praise for a first novel and a lot of pressure on the follow-up, which might explain the 7 years between that and Wellness. But also Wellness, like The Nix, is a pretty long novel, so that might explain it too. There's a lot to unpack there, and fortunately, we've got a great group of readers to break it all down for us, and I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves now. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Ken. I'm Susan Neville, and I used to teach English at Butler University. I'm retired, and I'm a writer.
And the name of your last book of short stories was?
The Town of Whispering Dolls.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Awesome title and an awesome book. Tracy, hi.
Oh, hi, Ken. Tracy Kumbe here, writer, hiker, baker.
Yeah, what are you baking?
You know what? I'm sticking with the straight-up sourdough lately.
Are you?
It's all sourdough all the time.
Yeah, nice. What are you doing with a discard?
Not much, actually.
Yeah.
Letting it go to waste.
Yeah, I just made a giant batch of Pop-Tarts.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, sourdough, leftover sourdough Pop-Tarts. They were really good.
And you didn't bring any in with you today.
I'm really sorry. I'm sorry.
Despite the apple turnovers in this book that
I know, shared with everyone. I know. I'm really sorry. Hey, we have a new book club member here.
Woohoo!
And I would like for her to introduce herself now.
Yeah, Kristen Baxter Howell. I am a longtime fan of Ken Honeywell.
Aw, that's sweet.
He once told me a great writer is someone who reads fiction. I'm not a great writer, but I read a lot of fiction.
Yeah,
so.
You're not a bad writer, Kristen. I've seen your work.
but I'm a dog parent extraordinaire, a reader, a hiker.
The person who turned me onto this book.
This was Kristen's recommendation. Well, thanks, Kristen.
Glad you could. We'll see if you thank me at the end of the.
Well, we'll find out, won't we? Before we dive into Wellness, I need to remind everyone this is book club discussion. We're going to spoil the book. There's a lot to spoil. So if you're planning to read Wellness and you want to keep the surprises surprising, this would be a good time to stop listening and come back after you've read it, which is easy because you can find this and all the episodes of Radio Free Book Club on Mixcloud or on WQRT.org, on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, just about anywhere you stream podcasts, podcatcher. Is that still what they're called? Podcatchers?
Podcatchers.
Yeah.
That's a new one.
If you want to listen to something right now, try one of WQRT's other great programs like the Purple Crown Show, hosted by Indianapolis musician and DJ Mr. Kinetic, whose birthday I think it might be today, featuring, and I quote, a solid dose of multi-generational funky soul music. And we can all use a little bit more of that. So please come back after you've read Wellness and listen to what is going to be a very interesting discussion, I think, starting now. Okay. What is everybody's familiarity with Nathan Hill? Did you read The Nix? Were you looking forward to Wellness, Susan?
I had not read The Nix, but I now have read The Nix, read it, and then Wellness, both. And my first response after reading the 1,200 pages is I wanted to call him up. I wanted to find him and just ask him questions, I guess. I don't know. Didn't, but.
Yeah. Yeah. Kristen, what about you?
Yeah, I had not read The Nix. Wellness, although it had been all over my Goodreads. And then Wellness, people just were going crazy about it. So I picked it up and then I read The Nix shortly after. So I'm now a part of the Nathan Hill fan club.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Tracy, you, did you read the Knicks?
I haven't read the Knicks, and I didn't even know Nathan Hill existed until Kristen told me.
Yeah. Yeah. I had read the Knicks, and I saw that his new book was out. And as much as I liked the Knicks, and I really did like the Knicks, I thought, oh my gosh, it's another 600 pages.
Sure is.
And it's, as I have expressed a couple times, it's a lot of Nathan Hill. And I read them back to back again, and it's a lot of Nathan Hill at one time. And I know, Susan, you did, maybe Kristen, you did too. Yeah, I was looking forward to it in a way because I really did like the Knicks. It was really surprisingly good. I remember thinking how funny it was and really even kind of how moving the story was. So, Tracy, you're pretty dependable on giving us a quick synopsis of what the book's about. What's the book about?
I'll try my hardest. It's about Jack and Elizabeth who fall in love when they're in college, when they're young and blazing trails, and then they're navigating marriage and parenthood. And they're so super excited about their relationship at the beginning, and they're so super excited about their lives as young people in Chicago, and then they're just really not very excited anymore, and that's what the book is about.
Yeah, I think that's a great synopsis. What'd you think? What worked for you?
Okay. I really loved this book. I'll just tell you right now. I loved it a lot, and partly because Jack and Elizabeth are very lovable and recognizable. A lot of what happens in this book hits a little close to home. So I have a lot of sympathy for these characters. And they're really trying their hardest to figure it all out. I feel like ultimately this is a book about one of my favorite topics, which is what a treasure it is when you actually do manage to connect with another human.
Hmm.
And how rare that is.
Yeah. Yeah. Susan, what'd you think?
Oh, what did I think? That was a great synopsis. And I loved the book as well. I thought it was very funny. And the thing that he's so good at to me is taking things that are in the air that you're worried about, that you're thinking about, and kind of explaining them, like, oh, I wish I'd known that, or you immediately recognize that you do in some ways know that. I think I'm fine with long books. I love long books, and especially if they're entertaining and funny. I wish it were shorter. Only because there aren't that many people who do like long books.
Yeah, right.
And we're thinking about, you know, books that would be good for that all the freshmen at Butler to read, like a common read. And there's so many chapters from this book that I think are important, like the whole thing about algorithms and Facebook.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, my gosh. And why the father and the son are angry with one another. And it all has to do with the way Facebook works and, you know, with... At one point, I think a character says we're all, you know, living in a hypertext and we don't know how to navigate it. There's so much information coming on. And so ideas like that were really fascinating to me. And I want there to be a Reader's Digest condensed version that I can hand to people who think they, you know, really could not possibly read anything longer than 180 pages.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of ideas in the book.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Really smart.
Yeah.
Smart ideas.
Yeah. Kristen, I think your enthusiasm for this book is what prompted this show. What did you think?
Thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure. I absolutely adored this book. He is a master researcher. I mean, the amount of time and effort that went into that, very respectable. But to simplify it, what I really, Nathan Hill does this wonderful thing of bringing things back around to just give you this warm, unbelievable feeling. And he does it a few times in this book. And it's just enough for the my reader self to just gush. And he does it so beautifully. And in a book this long, it's nice to get some payoff.
Yeah, like
once
what,
in a while.
Like, do you have an example of that?
One of my favorites is the come with. He says it to Elizabeth when they're dating, when he pulls her out of the bar, and then his sister, you then find in the interaction,
right,
just gives him the gentle come with, and that just beautifully full circle just showed how deep his love and affection was for his sister and how it carried with him. That was one of my favorites.
Yeah Great example. Susan, one thing you said in email and I thought was interesting was that this felt like a very American novel. And I was reflecting on that, and I think it is too. And I think even more than that, it's like an American white guy novel.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was thinking about it because I've been reading all these Booker Prize finalists, and so they're books written in Ireland, and they're so very different in the concerns. I mean, the concerns in this book, I can't really put my finger on it, but they're very much like things that we're all thinking about right now in this particular place, and trying not to think about other things like refugees. And it felt like a very American and white guy. Well, probably.
Well, I just think it's interesting. Like, this is the 21st time we've done this show. This is only the fifth time a white American author has been the subject of our show.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I'm sure that would have been a lot different, you know, even 10 years ago. I think that mix probably would have been a lot different.
It would have been a lot different. And I wish I could think of other people, and I'm sure there are, you could get a million calls saying, you know.
Yeah, right.
But who are, I mean, like the Knicks and this book, he's so interested in kids getting lost in video games and, you know, things about technology and the internet. And that's not all it is. But that seems like a very young American white male kind of perhaps concern, you know, as a major concern. The thing that was also kind of American, but beautiful to me. Not that being American isn't beautiful, but, you know, there are all these kind of Willa Cather almost chapters. I mean, he clearly loves the description of the prairie in the American Midwest.
Yeah.
And those chapters that came in, they almost made me cry because it's like, oh, God, somebody's looking at this reality again, you know, and in a very, very beautiful way. He describes a funeral in a church, you know, basement or something.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my gosh, that is spot on perfect.
And it was just like
every
one
detail.
Long paragraph of all that detail.
Oh, it was so
great.
It's so amazing.
Yeah. So in the first part of the book, the characters meet, they're falling in love, they're living in Wicker Park that, you know, 20 years later has gentrified. Is that, you know, Tracy, is that, does that ring familiar to you? Did you live a more bohemian lifestyle? Is it, you know, is it inevitable that you grow out of that?
Gosh, it seems pretty common, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Jack was living in that abandoned building, which is not something I would have tolerance for really at this point in my life if I could avoid it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there is kind of a shift, but they are certainly having a hard time with that.
Yeah, right. Couple of couple of quotes from the book that relate to that that I just thought were great were, hipsters are capitalism's prospectors, mining the earth for the next trendy thing. I mean, look at what's happened to Fountain Square, for example, right up the road from here. I mean, we were there when it was really bohemian, when, you know, shoes and shirts were optional at Subway. And it is, I mean, it's gentrified, and I don't know quite how, when once it starts, quite how to stop it.
I don't know if anybody knows that, but I think that's a, I mean, they're Generation Xers, and and I think most cities, at least I'm as a part of Generation X, you've seen this everywhere, gentrification.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all happened around the same.
Yeah.
The same time.
The bohemian neighborhood has turned into a yuppie neighborhood with a bohemian theme.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, that is a lot of neighborhoods in every city. So,
by the way, I thought it was a great detail that they were going to have that reclaimed barnwood in their forever home.
Oh, yeah.
His dad
that was so
had
great.
Been selling it in Kansas, back in Kansas.
That's so wonderful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What did you think when you learned that Elizabeth was using her research questions on Jack?
I hated that.
What do you mean? Why? Why?
Why? Well, I just, it was a nice plot twist, I guess.
It's so anti-romantic.
But yeah, it's completely anti-romantic. And I just so believed in the Elizabeth character of the first chapter, that beautiful kind of hippie chick with the flower dresses that lives in, you know, a bohemian apartment and hangs out with artists. And so I don't know, I didn't, I believed in the true love of those two people staring across an empty alley into one another's apartments and falling in love.
Hang on.
Okay.
does the fact that she asked these particular questions negate the true love element of it? Because I don't think it does. And I think that's a big part of what this book is about.
Okay. Say more about that.
Okay. She is all about the placebo effect. That's what she's doing in her job. And it's what she's doing kind of surreptitiously. And that's the same thing that she's doing with Jack by asking him the questions that are designed to make somebody fall in love. So first of all, she's asking random men these questions in a research setting, and she is not falling in love with any of them. So there's not that love, falling in love can't be one-sided. She asks them of Jack, and then they are spectacularly in love. And that has way more to do with other things happening around them and between them than it does just the questions. But dang it, now I forgot my second point. Oh, the placebo effect. So it's true that your mind can solve a lot of your physical problems anytime under the right circumstance if you are able to convince it. And it's the same thing with love, and a lot of what this book is about is whether you're choosing the love over and over again.
I see that completely, and that love at the beginning, I really felt, I think maybe hating it was the fact that it came so late, you know, knowing that that happened. Because it's like, I question, like I'm sure anybody would, so was all of it fake?
No.
Yeah. I know it wasn't. Because the placebo is real.
Yeah, and one of the most brilliant things he did with this book was that first chapter, in my opinion. I would follow them to the ends of the
absolutely
earth.
Intoxicating
this love story, and how it was set up was so beautifully done. And he just pulls you in. I was behind them no matter what came out later.
So, but didn't Elizabeth treat like her whole life like it was a research project?
Yes, 100%.
Oh, poor Toby.
Poor Toby.
Right.
Oh my gosh. But it all comes from this, especially with Toby. I think it comes from a very earnest place. She's just trying to do what she really feels is right. And it's just heartbreaking that she can't get there. She just can't.
Yeah. Well, what do you think, you know, we're talking about the placebo effect. How is what Elizabeth was doing? I mean, is it any different or better than what faith healers do or like snake oil salespeople do?
No,
you know, people who we really look down on, right?
Do you mean in her job?
Yeah, in the business.
Yeah, I mean, what she finally came to was using placebos to help people.
Mm-hmm. The
love potion. Right, the love potion.
Which she gave to Brandy, which I loved so much.
Right.
That was very gratifying, yes.
Very gratifying.
I mean, is that...
Oh my gosh, they even have different signs to try to manipulate people with fonts.
I know, well, that was so interesting.
Brilliant in the book to include the fonts as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there weren't any ramifications. She shut down the bit, and that was it. Nobody came back and sued, or unless Nathan just figured that wasn't an important...
I guess the only ramification is that they end up having, I mean, the condo is burned down.
Yeah, but they're not going to lose out on that.
Yeah, that's true.
It burned, and I mean, she just kind of walks away from that. So is it bad that she did that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess, but would you say the same thing about a faith healer or about someone selling snake oil?
Or a therapist who's maybe not giving you a pill, but they're absolutely giving you words and actions and...
Oh, the placebo effect is so huge. I mean, in this book, it's like, you know, a toothpick in the back works the same as acupuncture and, you know, all these things. So they decide to go ahead and just give people placebos. But is it the same as, probably, yeah, of course it is the same as a faith healer. I mean, it's all about belief. And, you know, what you believe about something, you kind of confirm by what you see. And so that's interesting.
But there was she wanted to make money. She was a capitalist with
Sure.
She wasn't doing out of her love of Jesus.
What did you think of her strategy for United Airlines? Basically, we're going
it's the strategy they use.
Right. We're going to make the flight experience crappier so people will be more accepting of like upcharges on baggage and stuff.
Expectations.
Right.
What Comfort Plus. You pay an extra $50 or $100
for a couple more inches of legroom.
Actually have legroom.
Yeah. I also wondered about, you know, there's the first big glimpse of it is when Jack is trying to like build up his biceps or something.
Yeah.
And he looks up all these different things and he tries all these different things and he finds out every one of them is wrong,
mm-hmm.
according to some
mm-hmm.
other expert out there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure you guys have encountered that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think he does that too with his father. I mean, you know, where they both have their sides, like we all know people on the other political side on Facebook or whatever. And you think, how can you believe that? How can you believe that? Because this, and this. And then all of a sudden he discovers, oh, there are a couple things I thought were true that were actually delusions as well. Mm-hmm. I've been suckered into these stories and then the stories make the reality of my world. And so there's that scene where the professor or the scientist sits down next to him or Elizabeth and says something about, I think I wrote it down, but it's about believe what you're going to believe, but believe it with humility.
Yes,
believe with curiosity. Yeah. Believe without sanctimony, and be as passionate about how you might be wrong as about how you might be right.
Yeah.
So, you know, people fall into a false sense of who they are, a false sense of who the other person is, a false sense of what they want from life, and
yeah, and now it's information overload. I mean, you go to research something and it's down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, for sure.
It's too much.
Yeah, diets. I mean, you know, it's gotten worse and worse, I think.
But to bring this full circle to your white male comment, I think this is a very common path of a white male as they age and their body starts to They lose their metabolism.
What are you implying, Kristen?
I'm implying that gym memberships and wearable activity trackers, and it's all a part of that life.
Yeah. I kind of forgot about that activity tracker. That was
that activity tracker is so scary.
But it's just such a common, as we grow up.
Right.
I mean, it's a step that you take in there, I feel like.
Yeah, I think so. Do you guys use any sort of thing like that?
We all have our Apple Watch.
Sure. Yeah, we do.
I don't. But I did.
You did.
There was a point when I had a Fitbit.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, is that like the opposite of the placebo effect? I mean, he's spending all his time researching how to get big biceps, and he's not getting big biceps, and I don't think he ever believed that he could. Is that fair?
Yeah, probably. I mean, he wasn't only researching, I think he was also trying these things, but I'm not sure he was giving anything long enough to, I mean, we don't know what the time frame is and all of that.
Right. But did he just go try something once and then the next day try something different?
That sounded interesting.
Again, there's so much to try. It's overwhelming.
Right.
So yeah, I think it's common for us to stick with something for maybe 20, 30 days and then it's on to something else.
Oh, I was going to say 27 minutes.
Oh, well, that too. But instant gratification, right? We all want that. We want the dopamine hit. And if it's not providing it, there's always something else.
Yeah.
And it's 2 seconds down on the scroll.
I mean, in both of his books, there are people who just get lost in scrolling and all of a sudden the morning's gone, the afternoon's gone, the next day is gone.
Yeah, except on Google. We all only look at the first page of Google.
That's right. Never go to the second.
Right. That was a quote on the book too, right? Something about what's the best place to hide something. It's on the second page
of Google.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
So, Susan, I think one of the other things that was interesting to me was the university where Jack teaches and the way it has become kind of corporatized. I don't want you to have to talk out of school or anything, literally, but does that look familiar to you?
Oh, it's such a spot on satire of the way, and maybe, you read it and it's like, this is daily life. I mean, especially in the Knicks, there are that one chapter where students talking.
Did you have that student ever? Hilariously funny.
Was so I didn't have that student, but I know people who did.
So well done.
You know, but then, and usually it's the guy who's the jerk in that situation.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that was interesting. And on the very day I was reading about the mission statement and, you know, all the things about my university was coming up with a new mission statement. And they do have several working groups, and people complain filled with, you know, clauses and semicolons and makes absolutely no sense. And it took several years to work on.
Did you ever feel pressure not just to publish, but to like have a high clout score?
Well, no,
I mean, that's so to speak.
I mean, that's a wonderful satire of the pressure that is there for people. Like, how many citations do you have if you're in the sciences, or, you know, philosophy, who's cited your article?
Yeah.
How do you say whether the press or the journal is a good journal? Things like that. But the idea of clout and numbers of Facebook followers and, TikTok, something going viral, and all of a sudden he gets a huge raise.
It's just
hilarious.
Tracy, who was the worst person in the book?
Brandy.
why was Brandy the worst?
Brandy is a big phony, and she's not letting people just live.
She's what's wrong with our country right now, in my opinion.
That's interesting.
Okay, I want to hear more about that, but I also want to ask, is what Brandy was doing with her little group any different from what Elizabeth was doing with her placebo thing?
Yeah. Well, yes. And here's why I say that. Brandy's, do you remember the scene where the woman was saying, I don't have diabetes?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and then Elizabeth was like, well, what does the doctor say? And she said, he's still finding diabetes, and I have to keep telling him I don't have diabetes.
Right,
and
it's Brandy, like word of faith religion.
Right, and Brandy is encouraging her. And I think at a certain point, you have to acknowledge that the experiment has failed, which I don't think Elizabeth would have. I don't think Elizabeth would have approached it in the same way, but I could be wrong.
Well, Elizabeth was careful not to make actual claims for what she was giving. She would say something like, people have experienced.
Right.
You know.
So she was craftier about it.
Right.
Sneakier.
And there's some line in the book where the doctor who's in charge of the placebo clinic says something about how the placebos work on certain kinds of problems, and I can't remember what the distinction was.
Yeah,
but it probably has something to do with the difference between diabetes and
right.
Well, it's not going to heal
love.
A broken leg, right?
Right. It was things that come and go, wasn't it?
That sounds right, but which one was the placebo and which one was, yeah.
Yeah. Tracy, while you're looking that up, Kristen, who was the worst person in the book?
I have thought and thought about this question, Ken, and I have found empathy for all of these characters somehow. I mean, he gave all of them kind of an out. His mother, Jack's mother, but then when you hear her backstory and it's really hard. And then Benjamin, the real estate, gosh, he was not a great guy, but he came through with these really prolific statements that just showed that he was more than just a money-hungry real estate developer. So,
right. And he came through with the crime,
crime at the end. Probably Benjamin in the end of it all.
Susan?
I think the father who's... Who is he? Who's
he's Elizabeth's name? Father.
Elizabeth's father.
Oh, that's
yeah.
true.
Oh,
he's extremely terrible.
He was terrible. He was horrible.
And we didn't find out about him until later in the book that was at the source of Elizabeth's issues with everything.
The father.
Well, can we talk about that a little bit? Did that bother anybody that so much of that? Why these characters are the way they are was left to the end of the book for both of them. You know, we didn't really know the root of Elizabeth's character until we found out about that whole incident. And the same with Jack, you know, we didn't know how his sister died. I think we probably assumed his sister was dead.
Right.
But we didn't know anything that happened until way late in the book.
It was definitely, Nathan's formula is, Jack and Elizabeth weren't honest with one another about a lot. Like Jack didn't tell Elizabeth about his sister.
Or us
until then. We kind of followed, it kind of made us feel how they felt in their marriage, I feel like. You're learning bits and pieces about these people until... You're finally let in. It's just that struggle to get there and for someone to be vulnerable and for someone to open up about it. And they still, I don't think they're still there with one another.
I think part of it is in both cases, the parents created a false reality for the kids.
Yeah.
And in both cases, the one father says, you did this, you broke all this stuff. And and the other one says, you killed your sister, it's your fault. And they internalize that. And another question that's sort of brilliant that runs through the book is, what's real? Bohemian is more real. This is really a real neighborhood because there's crime in it. And that, maybe that's a placebo effect, too, if your parents create a reality that's absolutely a delusion and you take it inside. And then how can you ever meet and relate to somebody else?
No, I had been wondering where the heck his sister was in the book, but it made sense to me that we didn't know when they were both keeping these huge parts of themselves back from each other.
It bothered me a little bit just because they were so divorced from their birth families, both of them. And I guess I feel like they had to have some kind of conversation about that, like why, you know, Elizabeth had never met Jack's family and why Jack had never met Elizabeth's family. And there had to be some explanation for that. I was having a hard time believing that they had kept all of that from each other. And so I felt a little bit like structurally, it probably was really good for the story. Mm-hmm. But I felt kind of like, maybe I should have known that. Kristen, one other thing I thought, I mean, you mentioned his research and really in the Nix was incredibly researched as well. Yeah. And so is this. Did you ever feel like he had to show us all his homework?
Yes. And to Susan's earlier point, this book could have been a lot shorter. And maybe because I have a tiny SEO background, I really did not like that portion. But yeah, the whole background, what was the name of that whole section? On analytics and diving into that.
Yeah, about all the algorithms.
I skimmed it.
Oh, I loved that section. That's the one I wanted to hand to students. You got to read this to figure out why your dad and your grandpa are like yelling at each other.
Right. Well, and you too, right?
Mm-hmm.
How is this affecting everybody? I thought it was really a kind of amazing look into how all those algorithms work together to create this horrible experience.
Yeah, I could have done without all of that.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, absolutely could have. It didn't add to the plot. It didn't add to the storyline. It was showing off his research. But it seems like some of our readers liked that extra education bit.
It was great how it was done, too, because I started out being like, oh, well, yes, everybody knows this, of course. And then it got really in the weeds, and I learned all kinds of stuff I'd never known before. Yeah. I never thought about.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. Susan, did you ever feel like hypertext was the future of literature?
I do remember being made to feel that way.
Yeah.
You know, when the book is so fun for me because I sort of watched the whole Pomo thing, you know, become a thing and everything change over those years. So it's you know, when, like the art instructor stops talking about the image in the art and it's just about what the art is trying to say. And the conceptual stuff and all the decon kind of language they use, and it's hilarious. And Nate Hill's so great with it because even has the character like get out of, he's taking naked pictures of of porn sites in the student lab once he figures out there are such things.
That was so
and then,
great.
Oh my gosh, what does he tell?
Did Jack not know about that?
Well, he goes from not knowing what the internet is at all to knowing everything about
his generation. I don't know, that just kind of boggled my mind.
It was pretty amazing.
As a Gen Xer, that just seems impossible.
Yeah.
Well, I'm recontextualizing the images in order to interrogate the non-being of the mediated body. Oh my God, I know people have written books about that. And it gets them out of so much trouble. Like, it's great.
It is.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just going to throw out a couple of quotes that I have gathered here and try to get a reaction, Tracy.
You already got one.
Parenthood's strange paradox, deeply annihilating, yet somehow deeply comforting.
Not wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Susan, what do you think?
Oh, yeah. True.
All right.
Fine.
Kristen, People are really insane, suffering all sorts of delusions, prey to the smallest stimuli, easily tricked, contradictory, self-sabotaging, untrustworthy, malleable, impulsive, acting according to motivations unknown even to themselves, making everyone miserable.
I mean, it's a yes until that making everyone miserable line. That goes far. That cuts deep.
Yeah.
But yes. But something to that point that I've noticed in his writing, there's numbing. They're numbing out, but not in a way that I think of people typically numbing out. Like, where's the alcohol? Where's the weed?
That's true, yeah.
Where, like,
it's juice and herbs.
Yeah, because I totally see Jack coming home, smoking a bowl on the couch, and, like, just zoning out to porn on the computer. And that's not what's happening with these people, which the whole numbing message just, I don't know. It's there, but it's missing some content.
Yeah, well, I mean, one way they tried to get past the numbing was the whole, who were they, Kate and Kyle.
Yeah, Kate and Kyle. We'll
talk a little about Kate and Kyle. What did we think of that whole thing?
I loved Kyle when he was talking to Elizabeth about Jack's work.
Yeah.
And what he saw in it. And he talks about how he really listened to her and saw her. And she needed that at that time.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that character because although they did not have a sexual connection that he maybe had hoped for at the swingers club, they definitely had an emotional connection. And I think that was really neat to see a man in this book that listened to a woman that really cared about what she was saying, and that even talked about her husband really kindly. I mean, he was just a great character thrown in there, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. Susan,
I thought that whole dialogue was really pretty great. But I also did think, I wonder if he has learned naturally to do what she has learned, you know, about making someone fall in love.
Right. Because
it was those kind of questions that...
Right.
That weren't those questions in the New Yorker or something?
I did a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Didn't publish.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. How interesting. One of the things that really stood out to me, one of the things in the book was something that a psychologist had told me years ago and had said pretty much everyone feels like this, which is, could you ever love someone as broken, as pathetic as me?
Mm-hmm.
Right? How, you know, why would anyone ever want to be my friend?
That's so sad.
I know. But I think almost everybody feels like that, at least at one point or another.
Yep. Absolutely.
You know? How can, right?
It's really relatable.
Yeah.
Maybe that's
unlovable?
The beginning of actual love, too.
Right.
You know, it's like...
Loving
yourself.
Yes,
I am broken. I'm broken. Yeah. See me.
Loving yourself before you can love anyone else. Or something like that.
I'm doomed. Now just admit you're broken.
You're doing just fine.
So let's talk about the art for a minute. You know, there's also this idea that to be financially successful, you have to, quote, do what you're told. Do you think that's true, to be a successful artist? Successful artist?
I don't... So I was just in this writing workshop with Melissa Phoebus a couple of weeks ago, and she said a great thing. One of the questions at the end of it was, how much should I be thinking about what's happening in the market while I'm writing my book? And she said, what's happening in the market is none of your business. You write out of what you want and what's inside you, and you do it with all the energy and passion you can muster. And then... push it out into the world and it's not yours anymore. And I really liked that. And she's financially successful. So no, doesn't have to be, but I certainly think there are people who take a different approach.
Yeah. Susan?
I don't know. You know, I don't know the answer to that question. If you're doing what people are telling you to do, you're probably, well, you can make art out of any kind of, can be the spark. You know, somebody says, I want a picture of a wishing well or something. I mean, it could look like Thomas Kinkade, or it could be something that, you know, you take as a spark in some ways. But the whole question of, you know, of art for art's sake and making, and capitalism run through this book too. I mean, his Polaroids, that when Benjamin meets him, he says, you know, well, this is what you feel, but you know people aren't paying attention to them or buying them because they won't appreciate in value because they'll just disappear. Right. And I sort of love that kind of art, you know, like the sand paintings by Zen
too.
Buddhists that, you know, it's just, it's the process. You watch the process and then it just disappears.
You know, he was talking about assigning value in the thing where the Elizabeth's mom was fondling her antique jewelry too. And she's like, it's a pearl. It does nothing for humanity. Like it's just there, but we've decided, which is always an interesting point to me too. Like, it's all just made up.
Yeah, it is. Everything's made up.
Yep.
And we're all crazy.
That's right.
Oh, believe delusions.
Can we touch on one of my favorite parts in the book that had to do with Jack's art is when his mother says, well, yeah, you've been drawing that fire over and over again for 15 years. And that just...
It's amazing.
That point in the book, that was one of those two that just got me...
It's really kind of devastating, isn't it?
It was.
It is 100%. Devastating.
She has suffered. She has suffered her own... Yeah, and it was devastating for Jack. Yeah, it was devastating.
But I think they all thought they were responsible for Evelyn's death. I mean, I think they all, there was blame being assigned as well, but Dad lit the fire. Mom maybe told him the wrong thing.
Right.
Right.
And he was blamed. Nine. Jack
yeah.
was
he
nine.
Was nine.
Yeah. I mean, I do get that. I do, you know, I had a really bad fire in my house when I was 13.
Oh, wow.
And I did for a long time. I had a lot of, and no one died or anything, but it was, I had brothers and sisters and parents in the hospital. Oh. And I had a lot of like survivor guilt.
Oh, sure.
For a while because I didn't get hurt. So I can really relate to that feeling, especially that feeling of, you know, someone dying in a fire.
Right. And also the person he most adored.
Yeah, right.
Which is an extra blow.
Who was saving
his life. Saving his life.
Well, and the person his mother adored. She was the chosen one.
Right.
Jack was the accident.
Well, she was the chosen one to the dad. Uh-huh. The mom was jealous of her.
Yeah. Well, right. And the dad would tell her that. And so he would just fuel that fire.
Yeah, right.
Which, was she really jealous? I mean, I don't know.
We don't know, right?
We don't know.
Well, let's talk about the ending. How do we like how it all wrapped up?
I absolutely loved it. I loved it. We went back to them when they were just babies, being in love. Like, and Jack asks, like, what do real couples do? And he romanticizes the whole thing. They just cling to one another for hours
gaze
at night.
Into each other's eyes.
I mean, just so naive and young. But I love that he takes us back to that that time when they were 20 years old. And I loved the whole soul leaving your body at night and turning into an animal and the mouse coming out of the mouth. It was beautiful. I loved it.
Yeah. And what did you think about the ending of like the real time story, the fire and the seeing each other across the alley?
That's the one part that did not sit with me.
How come?
It just was so easy, I guess. And it was so contrived in a way. I loved the fire. I loved that it happened. I hated Jack was there. And then Elizabeth went and waved and he didn't see her wave at first. And then... I don't know.
It's kind of the rom-com.
Oh, ending, it is. It is. Right? And I thought it could have been so much, so much more.
Yeah, it got me.
Well, did it? Yeah, it got me, too.
What's wrong with me?
I'm with you, Kristen. I thought it was a little over the top.
I read a lot of romance, so perhaps I've
I don't. I think that's it.
That might be it. I've seen this over and over, and I just thought they deserved so much more.
It's funny because we talked about a couple of things that seem contrived and good for the story, and but you know, then at the end we're like, "What? I'm not sure that that's right." But would we have enjoyed it if that didn't happen, or if we'd known things we wanted to know early? It's like you can just watch the strings being pulled all over the place.
600+ pages, and there's one part that, or a couple parts where I'm like, I mean, that's pretty good in my opinion.
Yeah,
amazing.
I agree with you.
I think John Barr said that every ending of a novel is just a controlled crash.
You know, I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, John Barr would
know. Or a controlled burn in this case.
Yeah, really.
Well, I don't, I guess I feel like I formally have to ask, would we recommend this book, Tracy?
I've recommended it so many times already, yes.
Yeah, Kristen.
Absolutely.
I mean, your recommendation is why we're even doing this today.
I do have just a little side note. I recommended this to my mother, and she read it, and it affected her, and she reads. I mean, she's a reader. It affected her so much, she couldn't talk about it. So stirred up some demons.
Oh, you know what? I got a text from a friend the other day who's reading this book after I recommended it, and she sent a little snippet and was like, oh, I'm just going to have to sit with that for a while.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it affects people. Yeah, my mom's about 77 now, and like, I mean, it just anyone.
There's so much in it. There's so much to think about. It's just jammed.
Yeah. Absolutely recommend it. Recommend The Knicks as well.
Yeah.
I do too.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with all of you. I've been recommending it. I recommended it today. Mm-hmm. I can't wait for Becky to read it because I want to just talk about it with her.
Yeah. Have you noticed a common theme in books? I know we're trying to wrap up, but where they're jumping back and forth. Like he does it in The Knicks too. Present day, past, and just kind of weaving it. I love that storytelling ability. Mm-hmm. I just think it's when it's well done, it's so well done.
Yeah. Really, really good. Yeah, really sounds enjoyed great. It. Okay. Who has a recommendation for our audience that is not Nathan Hill related?
I do.
Tracy.
I'm going to guess.
Okay, look, I'm so far behind the curve on this one, and I know you've already talked about it, but I just read Demon Copperhead.
I'm never going to be the same.
That character is just phenomenal, and it was so nice to spend that much time with him and look at life and look at that part of the country through his eyes. It was phenomenal. So good.
Yeah. But what an amazing voice, eh?
Yes. Brilliant. She set such a hard task for herself and then pulled it off for all those pages. I don't know how big it was, but it's a lot of book. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Have you read any other Kingsolver books?
The Poisonwood Bible.
I've tried a few and I've never really connected with them. So this was a surprise.
Okay.
Kristen.
Yes.
Do you have a recommendation?
I do.
Let's get it on.
Not sure how well this is going to land. I read a lot of fantasy, too, and I've happened to be in this mythology fantasy kind of vining that's been happening. But Madeline Miller, she wrote Circe, and then her newest is Song of Achilles. And they're just...
They're wonderful.
They're wonderful. Just beautiful storytelling. And if you have any ounce of interest in mythology, they're just wonderful.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to whatever she does next.
Oh, yeah.
Because those were two of my favorite books.
Wow. Great. Great recommendation.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kristen.
You're
Susan.
Again.
Well, I know you're talking about this in the next session, but I was going to recommend Kaveh Akbar's Martyr. It's really a great book. And he went to Butler and he also went to Purdue. So you can see little bits of Purdue in it. And it's just I think it's a really important book. And then also one more Prophet Song by Paul Lynch, I think.
Yeah.
Won the Booker last year.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to both of them. Okay. Well, probably kind of a lame recommendation, but I'm going to make it anyway because I've been reading nothing but Nathan Hill recently. So I thought, what do I just want to recommend and read again?
It's going to be Proust.
It's not going to be Proust, but I thought about it. So a couple of weeks ago, I was like flailing around for a movie to watch that fit the weird mood I was in. And I just somehow decided that more than anything, I wanted to watch The Swimmer, which is this great film from 1968 starring Burt Lancaster as Nettie Merrill, who realizes one afternoon that, you know, he's at the house of friends. He realizes he can swim home by going through the backyards of all the people he knows between where he is and his house. And he sets off to swim home. And yes, it is based on a short story by John Cheever, which is included in The Stories of John Cheever, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1979, and it won the National Book Award in 1981. And I'm not sure what else you have to say about that, but there are so many great stories
in that book. Really great stories.
Oh, my gosh. Goodbye, My Brother, The Enormous Radio, Oh, Youth and Beauty, The 548, The Country Husband. The Geometry of Love is one I love as well. And I've read them, I can't tell you how many times. And I'm not sure why they affect me so deeply. I kind of grew up on kind of in that region of the country at that time. Not that my mom and dad were anything like the characters in Cheever books, but I think that's part of it. But the writing is just so beautiful, just kind of sentence by sentence, beautiful. So if you love short stories and you've never read John Cheever, oh my gosh, go.
Added to Goodreads.
Yeah. So how's the movie?
Oh, if you are a fan of surreal films from the 60s and want to see Burt Lancaster in swim trunks for a couple of hours, it is pretty awesome.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you can find it on Tubi and that kind of stuff.
I think Burt Lancaster was my first love.
Oh,
That's how old I am.
He was quite a hunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he played these wacky characters, like Rainmaker.
Yeah, it's really quite good. And John Cheever has a cameo in it as well.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. And that's it for the show. You can find notes for this and all of our shows at the Radio Free Book Club blog on Medium.com. Please think about following us and dropping us a note on Facebook and stream the show wherever you listen to podcasts. We always want to know what you think about the book and the show. For Tracy Kumbe, Susan Neville, Kristen Baxter-Hell, and all the members of Radio Free Book Club, I'm Ken Honeywell. Thanks for listening, and join us next month when we'll be reading, as Susan has already spilled the beans on, the brand new novel by the poet Kaveh Akbar. It's called Martyr with an exclamation point. Until then, read a book.